Odyssey Global Media recently held a grassroots global autism conference focusing on the theme of lived experiences and hearing from the insights of individuals from a local to a global level. This podcast is a snapshot of that conference, noting that the views of the individuals do not necessarily represent the views of Odyssey Global Media, and that it was a space to discuss perspectives and insights of individuals to carry forward the human narrative.
Okay, so when I approached this presentation about why accessibility to arts is important, I thought about why it's important for everybody, you know? And to me, this title that I've given the presentation kind of sums that up: ways of seeing, listening, and speaking. So we have a bit of a problem in the arts and mass media that autism has been portrayed as kind of tragic or defective. There's lots of negative stereotypes around, or it's like the polar opposite of that, and people with autism are meant to have, like, you know, superhuman kind of powers. And, you know, we're not all Rain Man. That is not how it works. And so I focus on the I in autism. Obviously, we all know that the spectrum is not like this nice linear line. It is more like a color wheel. And there's different aspects of the spectrum that apply to different people. And some parts of the spectrum will not apply at all. And I think that it's really that individual approach that's really important when it comes to accessibility in the arts. If you've met one person with autism, then you've met one person with autism, you know? So I decided to share some incredible contemporary artists who are accessing art for various different reasons. And this is literally the tip of the iceberg because we only have a bit. So we're starting with Naim Jahn, and this is really these abstract pieces are really about their everyday lived experiences and trying to share something about how that feels. So it's a communication tool for inviting other people into lived experience. And next, M. Gurren, who's worked super interesting. So these little pieces look like they might have been cut on a laser cutter, but actually they have been cut by hand. And that process is super important to the artist because it's a way of reconnecting with their authentic self and reminding themselves they're not meant to be aiming for perfection. Masking is not necessarily a helpful thing for them. And to be their true self with all of the flaws and embrace every part of themselves is something that's really important to them. And they feel like making artwork, the process of making artwork helps with that connection. To hear what's really important to them is that they are, representatives of the whole person. And I think that that's something that is important to the autistic community as a whole, actually, in my experience. Next, I have got Margot Wasp, who is a contemporary practicing artist with autism, and her pieces are sold at various art fairs and also in galleries, but there are conditions on the sales. So she is using her artwork as an educational tool to try and share information outside of the autistic community about what it is like to be on the inside community. And so wherever her work is displayed, there is also information about her lived experience as well as facts about autism, and these also go out with the artworks once they're sold. So a form of advocacy and an active position from Margot with her artwork. Jeremy is a really interesting artist and sells a lot of work in some really important galleries. And I think that what's really great about Jeremy's story is that he's writing his own narrative in a way that all people should be able to. But he was told for the majority of his life that his life was going to be a certain way, and that there were certain limitations and that there were certain rules and restrictions and ways that he was going to have to live. And actually, his painting has made an independent life for him, so he can pay for his own house and he can pay for his own care, and he can make decisions about things and have an autonomy in a way that wouldn't have been possible without this income stream and also this identity. And it's that identity. I'm ending this, the last artist. I'm ending with Mitchell Brager, because this quote, I think, which is actually from his mother, and it's the bottom bit. It was awesome for Mitchell to be known as an artist instead of the strange guy looking in shop windows and touching everything. And there's a whole article, and his mother has said how important it is for him to feel that connection and to feel like a part of society, and to be accepted as part of society.
Juan Covenas from Argentina. Thank you. For having me today. Thank you for having me today. And thank to Tiandi. I will share my presentation.
I had the experience of being excluded even from special schools. The reason was that I could not speak or make conventional gestures, so they said I was uneducable. The exclusion from the places where every other child goes throws us to a world of inequality. Assisted communication, or the facilitated communication training, as Rosemary Crossley named it, meant liberation from seclusion and isolation. The Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities enshrines the right to use our preferred form of communication. When this form of alternative augmentative communication is part of academic research, any project must fulfill the requirements of the studies with human subjects, and the research must count with the informed and meaningful participation of the persons with disabilities involved, who must be supported by their regular communication assistants and those who know them best. My proposal is that the CRPD is the framework for every decision taken by education authorities and experts, and also for any other laws and policies in every country that ratified the CRPD. And please, presume competence. Thank you very much.
So, today I stand before you to address a critical issue that affects countless individuals and families around the world, the regulation of autism service providers. Very recently, I have also discovered myself that I am on the autism spectrum. Autism is a complex neurodevelopmental condition which requires specialized care and support to help those that are affected lead fulfilling lives. About 1% of the population has autism, according to statistics. About 1 in 100 children has autism. Characteristics may be detected in early childhood, but autism is often not diagnosed until much later, according to the World Health Organization. And evidence-based psychosocial interventions can improve communication and social skills with a positive impact on the well-being of both the individual with the condition and the caregivers. However, care for people with autism needs to be accompanied by actions at community and societal levels for greater accessibility, inclusivity, and support. In May 2014, the 67th World Health Assembly adopted a resolution entitled Comprehensive and Coordinated Efforts for the Management of Autism Spectrum, which is supported by more than 60 countries. And the resolution urges the World Health Organization to collaborate with member states and partner agencies to strengthen national capacities to address autism spectrum and other developmental disabilities. Firstly, it's really essential to acknowledge that incredible dedication and hard work of many autism service providers who strive to make a positive impact. However, the absence of standardized regulations means that anyone can claim to be an autism service provider without sufficient qualifications or training. This poses significant risks to the well-being and progress of individuals on the autism spectrum. By implementing regulations, a global regulations for autism service providers, we can ensure a high standard of care and protect the rights of those seeking assistance. This also leads on to quality insurance. Regulations can establish minimum standards for qualifications, training, and experience, and ensures that individuals seeking services seek care from professionals who possess the necessary expertise. Standardization guidelines can help maintain consistent quality across providers, leading to improved outcomes for individuals with autism. Too often, we also find that individuals who go to specific organizations that deal with autism care are not fully able to access those support services, or they might even face discrimination from those that are saying that they are helping them. And we need to kind of have some sort of regulatory framework that looks into this, because it also concerns safety and ethics. Regulations can set forth ethical guidelines that all service providers must adhere to. This includes ensuring the safety and well-being of individuals with autism, maintaining confidentiality, and promoting inclusive and respectful practices. By enforcing these guidelines, we can prevent potential abuse, negligence, or exploitation of vulnerable individuals. It also is important in terms of accountability and oversight. Regulation enables the establishment of governing bodies or regulatory agencies responsible for monitoring and enforcing ethical compliance. And these entities can conduct regular inspections, review practices, and respond to complaints from service recipients. Such oversights ensure that providers are held accountable for their actions, fostering a culture of transparency and continuous improvement, as well as professional development, which can promote ongoing training for service providers. Because what we are finding now is that there's still a lot that we do not understand about the autism spectrum, and it is a spectrum. There is no one size glove that is a fit for all. Everybody has an individual experience, and this is why regulation of autism service providers is very important, as well as ensuring that those who are neurodivergent, that those who are on the autism spectrum, they are involved, their voices are heard, and they are part of that process of regulation, because we have to take into account the voices of those who actually experience the condition to understand their perspective, to understand how we can make services more inclusive. For instance, on this platform today, as a global conference, we are hearing varying insights, and we are also hearing from individuals who are on the spectrum at varying degrees to sort of hold a meaningful conversation to move forward. And there needs to be more avenues, more regulation, where individual children and adults on the autism spectrum are simply heard, are simply listened to.
So I'm a 45-year-old autistic ADHD, a full-time mother of two charismatic boys, aged 6 and 10. The older one is autistic ADHD like me, and the younger one is ADHD like his dad. I was identified autistic ADHD in June 2019, and my son identified autistic 11 days later. I use the term identified and the discovery because I don't believe that medicalizing and pathologizing autism is conducive to the autistic community and how we are perceived from the point of view of society as being, you know, valid, valuable members of society and not something to be cured or got rid of. So I feel it's important to mention that I am one definition of autism and I can only share how I perceive the world. This piece is based on my opinion only. Excuse me. There's very little known on what autism looks like without trauma. If you too are late discovered, allow yourself to grieve. It took me 2 years to grieve the 40 years I'd lost, not knowing who I was and never living, just coping and copying others in order to avoid unwanted attention and to try and gain a sense of acceptance that all humans need. This is just a moment that will ebb and flow, but always moving you forwards. And in 2 years from now, you'll likely be in a much better place, as I am now 5 years into understanding myself. And looking back, the difference in me is profound. I am more confident. I am more emotionally resilient. And when people call me wrong, like the wrong labels, which is any label that's just not very nice, I can deflect them. They don't stick anymore because I know who I am. So, which is why I'm always saying the correct labels save lives and wrong labels destroy them. The reason why I sign is because I think signing helps me because I think in pictures. I don't think in words at all. When I'm reading a book, I can only read the book if I can visually translate it in my head and build the picture as I read. If I can't do that, then I can't read the book. It's just a bunch of words that on their own mean something, but altogether don't mean anything. So it was assumed that when I was little that I wasn't very bright and that I would never amount to anything because I think they thought that because I couldn't read that it meant that I wasn't very clever. It wasn't until I was 26, I was sent on a course through, I was supporting deaf students because I'm fluent in British Sign Language, and it wasn't until I was 20, probably 25 actually, that they discovered that I'm dyslexic, and then that helped me understand a little bit of me, but I still felt that there was something else. And it wasn't until I was sort of, you know, 40 and then 41 for ADHD. So I was 40 for my autism discovery and 41 for my ADHD discovery. My ADHD was identified at the 98th percentile, which I thought was great, but the doctor said, no, that's not good. It means that you have severe ADHD on both types. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I want to perceive that as a good thing. So I digress. I'm very good at this digressing. Right. I feel anxious when communicating, not knowing the point of the communication. So I prefer to know the context. Put me in the picture, as it were. When I'm asked about my weekend or how, you know, or something like that, I forget to ask the question back, which is, you know, the societal expectation of the predominant neurotypes and non-autistic people to sort of answer, you know, to say, oh, it was great, thanks, and then respond back and ask them. But I always forget to ask because I go off in my head about what I did on that weekend and lots of different like visual pictures keep opening up and then I'm distracted by that going off. And anyway, what is autism? So you might think you know about autism, but unless you've met every autistic person, then you can't know everything about autism. My insight takes you one person closer to knowing more about autism. Autism is a neurotype and not a disease or a disorder. The predominant neurotypes are non-autistic people is a neurotype and not a disease or a disorder. Although during COVID, it turned out that they realised that how disabled they were because they weren't allowed to socialise. And yeah, a lot of autistic people were like, this is great, get to stay at home. Anyway, yeah, that's a point I wanted to make, sorry, rather badly. As with any neurotype, no brain is the same. Each brain has its own strengths and weaknesses. Take a fish out of water and subject it to on-land expectations and she'll fail to meet them. Take away the hedges from hedgehogs and their numbers decline. Either way, the environment is the problem here, not the creatures. Neurodiversity includes predominant neurotype brains because their brain type is part of the neurodiversity of human brains. To be neurodivergent is to be not predominant neurotype, but autistic, ADHD, dyslexic, etc. My analogy of this is to see predominant neurotype brains as being on the motorway and neurodivergent brains taking the slip road away from the predominant neurotype. Motorways are great for getting to places fast, but if there's an incident, then it's gridlocked. Slip roads lead to smaller roads, which take longer to navigate and travel, but the options are broader and less restrictive. Autistic brains are filterless. Predominant neurotype brains have filters. The analogy of this is the predominant neurotype has a handbasket and the autistic person has a trolley full of data to put through the till. It's not that we're slower at processing the information, it's that we have a greater amount of items in our trolley compared to the handbasket, which will obviously get through the till much faster than us. Autistic brains are filterless. Oh yeah, I have done that one. Sorry. Autistic brains are mostly monotropic and predominant neurotype brains mostly polytropic. These differences influence each neurotype's experience of the world. We see a nine and they see a six. Neither is right or wrong, it's just different. Terravance's identity model of autism. Autistic folks base their identity on passion and values. This isn't obviously all autistic people and the same for not all predominant neurotypes, but predominant neurotype folks base their identity on social belonging. So I would find it less important to fit in and more important to do what is morally right. Whereas a non-autistic predominant neurotype might find it more important to fit in than to do what is morally right. Autism plus environment equals outcome, Bearden 2017. The environment, this includes the people and strategies used in any settings, which are often perceived as hostile to autistic individuals and triggers a fear response. Societal environments are often ill-equipped to support autistic people. Everyday life can become incredibly distressing, leading to a heightened risk of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's Kupferstein, 2018. Autistic people are 9 times more likely to unalive themselves than non-autistic people. That's Cassidy et al, 2014. And as a late discovered autistic ADHDer, I'm now 45, I can confirm that my own suicidal ideation and attempts have been as a consequence of never feeling a sense of belonging. Wrong and hurtful labels, constant rejection and gaslighting when my perception of sensory overload is constantly denied validity, resulting in me hiding my pain in order to avoid unwanted attention. If we better accommodated autistic people and allowed us to share our insight without judgment or suspicion as to the validity of our discomfort, then autistic people could feel safer and consequently be able to thrive rather than coping. Am I right for time or am I?
Rachel, it's fine. Please, it's okay. You're doing great. Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry. Who wants to spend their life treading water on the brink of drowning while being expected to perform day-to-day tasks that, if not done, are then shamed and rejected? The non-autistic person placing the expectations on the autistic person, they don't need to tread water and can't empathise because they can't see the water that we're drowning in. That's about the double empathy problem and cross-neurological theory of mind. The first one is Milton 2012 and the second one is Bearden 2008. Autistic people are often conditioned to subjugate their needs for the comfort of others, often done with best interests. But what's best to a non-autistic person is likely not what's best for an autistic individual. That's what I always say. When my son was told by the local education authority that he needs to learn social skills, that I said He has great autistic social skills. His non-autistic social skills are likely better than this particular person who I was talking to, their autistic social skills. So, but basically what I'm saying there is that it's not that autistic people lack social skills, it's that we have different social skills to that of the predominant neurotype, and that they are not to be corrected, and our behaviours are not to be shut down, and that we should be allowed to take the form that nature intended us to, and that those differences should be celebrated and not sort of snuffed out, as it were. All of this can be avoided if a non-autistic dominated society actively listened to autistic people. If life was adapted to meet the needs of autistic folk, that non-autistic folk might also benefit, because it's been identified and shown to reduce anxiety for all humans, which means that we then have an improved access of our executive function that then allows us to be more flexible and less rigid. And that's not about autistic people, that's about humans generally. Meeting need as though all humans are autistic won't harm non-autistics, but non-autistics having their needs met is and are harming autistic people. Privileges like this is something that, in my opinion, does not make it right. A right to feel safe with a sense of belonging is essential to the well-being of all humans. Thank you for listening.
I want to introduce you to a program that a speech pathologist and I developed several years ago. We formed a company called Making Sense of Autism. We're both neurodiverse. I'm autistic. She's ADHD. And we both felt very strongly that the current approaches being used to address the needs of those on the autism spectrum were not neurodiverse affirming due to the lack of understanding of the differences and how the autistic brain works. So we drafted a research proposal that we submitted to Arizona State University for approval to demonstrate that by better understanding how the autistic brain works based on current research, OTs and SLPs could better support the needs expressed by autistic individuals, and by doing so, establish a more meaningful and successful relationship with them. So we developed an 8-course training module that covered the topics of how to interpret and support autistic ways of responding, i.e. addressing their very misunderstood behaviors, identifying and building on autistic strengths and sources of motivation versus giving them rewards and withholding what they want in order to teach them to perform in ways acceptable to the therapist or educator, and research into the autistic neurological differences that impact on our attention, our ability to process, recall information, as well as our awareness of our own body and emotions that impact on our motor control and self-regulation. These are areas of neurological difference that are not currently being recognized, respected, or supported. The final two training modules focused on one, assessment and development of goals that target autistic identified functional needs, not teaching them rotely learned skills based on what the therapist perceived as their deficits, and two, how to use assistive devices and teach the way autistics learn versus how therapists instinctively know how to teach, while providing the supports that autistics need and what they want to learn into every therapy session. Each training module starts off by identifying why the current approaches in this area were not meeting the needs of those on the autism spectrum, explained what research has shown were the differences in brain functioning that were not being recognized or supported, and then we offered them tools and strategies that would better support and motivate autistic individuals. The results of the study demonstrated statistically that it is possible to help therapists, regardless of their number of years' experience, view autism from an autistic perspective and improve both the supports they were providing to their clients and the goals they choose to work with them on achieving. Based on their feedback, the greatest benefit these therapists discovered while using these strategies was an immediate improvement in the connection between them and their clients. For autistics, the purpose of the neural strengths-based framework is to decrease the continuous need to mask, which only leads to burnout, trauma, depression, and suicide. We are currently preparing the study for publication and the training modules for purchase by therapists, educators, and other professionals. Once this is accomplished, my next goal is to hopefully put this information into a book format.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Anna. Today, I will start by introducing myself, who I am, what I do, and talk about my professional and also my studies, my PhD in autism. So I'll start by introducing myself. My name is Ghaffaria Khan. I live in London. I'm a mother. I am the first generation graduate in my family. I also identify myself as autistic and have been diagnosed with ADHD last summer. So I've received a very late autism and neurodivergent diagnosis, which comes with a lot of emotions and feelings, but also a lot of clarity and perspective, and I'm able to make sense of my lived experience so far. I work as a specialist mentor, whereby I support students at university or in higher education remotely that have mental health conditions or that are autistic. And what we do is we meet weekly or every 2 weeks just to check in how they're feeling, how I can support them in their well-being and making sure they are enjoying their experience at university, but also have a safe and confidential space to talk about any worries they might have, because I'm not associated with any university. That makes our conversations quite unique. I'm also not a qualified therapist, so our meetings are not necessarily therapeutic meetings, but I can signpost them to relevant services if I feel they may be helpful to the particular student. So that is my professional experience so far, whereby I noticed quite a huge increase in more South Asian or people of colour that were diagnosed with autism or that are self-identifying and asking for the support of mentoring. So when I started my PhD in 2022, in April, I decided to change my proposal and come up with the study that I've just conducted. So my first study as part of my PhD is a qualitative study whereby I have conducted interviews and I'm still recruiting and to hear about the lived experience of what it means for South Asian autistic adults that live in the UK and that have tried to access or have access and been involved in talking therapy for their mental health. We do know, the literature has shown us that talking therapy is a very helpful and effective intervention to support people that have mental health problems or concerns, but also on a preventative basis. So I would like to understand, what does it mean for a South Asian autistic adult to be involved in therapy, but also what are the barriers and the facilitators, so that hopefully we can inform services to make adaptations to ensure that we can facilitate and improve the existing talking therapy services. My aim of my PhD is to include South Asian autistic adults in the existing narrative, which I still have a few more studies to conduct, but this was my first study and it has been very rewarding so far. And I'm very grateful to take part today, because I do think the more we have these conversations, the more we talk about our lived experience, the more people will feel comfortable and safe to talk about their experience of what it means to be autistic. And hopefully we can remove this stigma and support each other.